The Senate Committee on Human Services and Early Childhood will come to order. It is not May 5th. It is May 7th. But May 5th was a good day. I suppose we could do it all over again. But alas, it's Thursday, and we are going to bounce around a little bit. We are going to start with House Bill 3016. So I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3016A.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3016A restores capital gains tax exemption for property sales to entities that include tenants, nonprofits, or housing authorities, modifies time limits for tenants to form or associate to submit purchase offer, increases assessment fee and reimburses county for processing, increases mobile home park registration fee, cancels unpaid taxes and assessments fees, prohibits mandatory consignment sales, clarifies rules for completing sales, applies to tax years beginning January 1, 2015, and before January 1, 2020, takes effect 91st day after signee die. This is a cleanup bill that comes after House Bill 4038 from 2014. Minimal revenue, a fiscal statement issued. There's no subsequent referral. Unanimous out of House Committee and off the House floor.
Great. Thank you very much. And we have Representative Nathanson, Representative Kennemer. And friends. Or not. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For right now, we'll just be the dynamic duo, and our friends will come in the next wave. Members of the committee, I am Nancy Nathanson, representative from House District 13. Oregon has more than 1,100 manufactured home parks located in, I believe, 29 of your 30 Senate districts. It provides more than 63,000 residential spaces for affordable housing. Nearly every legislative session since 1997 has had a bill negotiated by the Manufactured Housing Landlord-Tenant Coalition, and this is another in that long history of collaboration. And I'm very pleased that Representative Kennemer is here with me today. I very much appreciate his help, and he's going to talk to you some more about that history. The bill in front of you today has over 30 hours of negotiations over a year that represents a consensus conclusion. There are several aspects to this bill. I'm just going to give a very high-level overview and allow you the opportunity to ask more detailed questions of others who will come after us. A housekeeping correction occurs in the bill. It was made to the capital gains exemption for landlords who sell their manufactured housing parks to their residents. The Manufactured Communities Resource Center will have expanded capacity. Landlords in certain situations will be able to have back taxes canceled on abandoned manufactured homes that remain in their parks. A couple of points amend the habitability requirements. And then finally, the bill includes a successfully negotiated solution to address conflicts of interest when a tenant is choosing to sell their home. When a park tenant who is a homeowner wants to sell or rent their home, there's an awkward relationship that begins to arise between the park owner or someone representing the park owner and the homeowner and prospective buyers of that home. This bill ensures that the homeowners who are tenants in the park and the park owner will be competing on a level playing field. And you'll get to hear an example of how that plays out. I am really pleased with the hard work that occurred over the past year and hope that you will look at this bill favorably. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Bill Kennemer, State Representative, District 39, and I thank you for the chance to be here and also to be here with Representative Nathanson. Her hard work has made this bill possible in part, and just a piece of information. Back in the previous century, as most of you know, I served in your chamber, and it was fun. In 1995, we were getting ready to have the typical war between the landlords and the tenants. And I was chair of business committee that year. And I said, you guys go out in the hall and figure this out because your bill's dead otherwise. And since then, we've had this wonderful coalition. It's tough to maintain, and huge credit goes to people for continuing across these years, voluntarily coming together and finding the middle ground that makes sense. This bill makes sense, and if we're not careful, we have a situation where either landlords have unfair gains at the expense of tenants, or tenants can be obstructive in the sale of parks. We find some middle ground here that makes great sense, and I encourage the bill to you, and I extend my appreciation to the Tenant Landlord Coalition for another fabulous job.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions for our good colleagues here? Senator Cruz?
Just a comment. There are two groups in this state that I think have made our jobs easier. One of them is this Landlord-Tenant Coalition, and the other is AMLAC. It's nice yep. when solutions are brought to us.
It makes life a lot easier, and I think in the long run it works better, too. Thank you, yes. Senator Cruz.
Great. Thank you very much. Anything further? Seeing none, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Next, we'll have John Van Landingham and Chuck Carpenter, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Van Landingham. I work as a legal aid lawyer in Lane County. Perhaps if I talk long enough, Chuck will arrive. Right. I don't want to take advantage of that. I am a tenant lawyer and have been for, 35 years. And for the last 20 or so, I have represented tenants in both this particular coalition and then there's a general landlord-tenant coalition whose bill Senator Cruz heard earlier in this session at Senate Bill 390. I was actually in the hearing room when then-Senator Kenemer sent us out into the hallway and said, don't come back. We didn't come back very quickly that time. It took a lot of time and work, and there have been times when the work was harder than others. And there have been times when we blew apart and weren't talking to each other. This has been one of the better times for this particular bill, and I think there are parts of this bill that benefit all of us, and that's why we all support it. I can talk detail about it a lot, and I will defer to the chair to tell me if she wants that. Let me just say a couple of things about it. There are a couple of other coalition members in the room that I want to recognize. One is Richard Kosasan, who represents one of the two park owner groups. The other park owner group is represented by Chuck Carpenter, whom I expected to be here. Genoa Ingram is also in the room, and Genoa represents the manufacturers of manufactured homes. And we meet at her office. She replaced Don Miner, who's a longtime member of the coalition. And then finally, Rick Blackwell, he wouldn't want me to refer to him this way, but he works for DCBS, our regulators, and he's participated especially in the conflict of interest sales issue that Representative Nathanson referred to. The bill addresses a couple of big issues and a couple of small issues, and I'll just touch briefly on the big issues. One of the big issues has to do with the Manufactured Community Resource Center, which is a program at Housing and Community Services Department, MCRC. MCRC provides education, advice, training, and mediation for both park residents and park landlords. It was created in 1989 in a session where this legislature came very close to imposing rent control and state enforcement in parks because of issues that are still there today, concerns. The legislature chose to do dispute resolution and created MCRC. It's funded entirely by a self-imposed tax on residents. So the residents have chosen to tax themselves to pay for MCRC. MCRC receives no general fund money. That tax initially in 1989 was $3. About 10 years later, the residents agreed to increase it to $6 in order to get more services out of MCRC. And in this bill, we're proposing to raise it to $10 for the same purpose, largely to be able to expand the services that MCRC can do. But at the same time, one of the other issues that we've faced has to do with how the taxes, this special assessment, is collected. It's collected with property tax bills. So the county does the collection for us. The county bills manufactured home owners pay personal property taxes on their manufactured homes. Manufactured homes are treated as personal property and not real property unless they own the land. They don't. They're renting the land in the parks. So they pay personal property taxes. The county bills those people, just like everybody else in the state, for property taxes. And in our case, they add on the $6 as a special assessment. So it's a very easy and effective collection mechanism for us. Some of the counties would rather not do it. They're purists. They just want to collect property taxes. Four of the counties don't have to do it, don't have to collect personal property taxes on low-value manufactured homes in a bill that was passed several sessions ago. They are set homes that are valued at less than 12.5, indexed currently to 16,000. It's the four biggest counties. That would be the Tri-County area plus Lane. And those counties have pointed out to us the anomaly that they are now only collecting on those low-value homes the $6 special assessment. And with the 3% early payment, it's less than $6 that they collect. So it's crazy that they're billing these homeowners for less than $6. It costs them more than $6 to do the billing process. So the bill will exempt those counties from collecting the $6 on those low-value homes. That will be a loss of revenue to MCRC. We make up that loss of revenue by raising the $6 assessment to 10. We also will compensate in this bill the counties for collecting that money by giving a portion of the increase. It's going to increase by $4 from 6 to 10. We're going to give a portion of that to those counties for collecting that. It's not a lot of money, but it makes them feel valued and appreciated and compensated for their work. So that's a compromise that we've worked out in the coalition. I want to give credit to, and then we've also done this compromise with abandoned manufactured homes and the back taxes on those abandoned manufactured homes in a very complicated trade for different things. And we worked both of those issues out with the help of Diane Belt, the tax collector for Washington County, and Tammy Little, the tax collector for Clackamas County. Diane Belt is the president of the state tax collector. She's worked with the coalition for more than 20 years. This is her last go-round. She's retiring at this year. We couldn't have done these sorts of things without her input. So both of those issues are included in the bill. Maybe you want to talk, Chuck, a little bit about the abandoned property compromise.
Thank you, John. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Chuck Carpenter, Executive Director of Manufactured Housing Communities of Oregon. We represent about 500 manufactured home communities here in the state. So over the last 10 or 12 years, we've had a situation develop in our communities where homes, when they became abandoned by the residents, the landlord was forbidden from purchasing that home unless he or she wanted to pay all the back taxes owed on that home. So with this has become complicated by the fact that the counties are no longer, in many of the counties, are collecting property taxes. So a home becomes abandoned and has more property taxes owed on it than what the value of the home is. So we're talking about homes that are worth very small amounts of money, $5,000, $10,000, and the taxes on sometimes on these homes is more than the value of the home. So the home is destroyed, and very often the space then is left empty, and it's really kind of a sad situation because we're losing a stock of affordable housing simply because of some bad tax policy. And sometimes the amount is not a small amount. We had a house in a home in Washington County 2 months ago, had $43,000 in back taxes owed on it. And nobody is going to buy that home and then pay the taxes and then try to sell it for $43,000 or more. So we thought this was a very, very important piece of legislation for us, something we've been trying to work on and get past the last 10 years, and we're thrilled that we're able to do it in this coalition bill, and we're very thankful that John has been so helpful in helping us articulate that.
So the compromise there works like this, that the county will cancel, or the state collects the senior property tax deferral program, tax property taxes, and DOR also participated with the coalition in figuring this out and has approved this approach. So the county or the state would cancel the back taxes. The landlord will sell the home to a buyer who will live, who commits to live in the park. The landlord can take from the sale price the money owed to the landlord for buying the home, fixing it up to make it saleable, and then anything over that goes to the county or DOR to go towards the back taxes. So and then if there's profit over that, the landlord gets to keep it. So there's some incentive for the landlord to try to maximize the sales price. We're hopeful that what we've done here is retain an affordable home in the park. The landlords are mostly interested in rent revenue going forward, not on the proceeds from the sale, get some property tax money, or at least get a property tax payer back in that home, and produce rent for the landlord. So that's that compromise. The other couple things I wanted to mention are that you're going to hear, I believe, testimony from a park resident in Representative Nathanson's district. I've met her. She testified in the House to talk about issues involving sales. So a manufactured home, if it can be sold what's called in place in the park, is worth a whole lot more than if it has to be pulled out of the park. It costs a lot of money to move a manufactured home from a park. It's hard to find a space to move it to. Some homes are not capable of being moved. So if you're a resident, you've got equity in that home, and you want to get equity when you are ready to sell the home. Landlords, on the other hand, want to make sure that whoever moves into their park is not Jack the Ripper or someone who's going to do bad things in the park. So the landlords have a reasonable expectation that they can screen the buyers. There's friction there in two ways. Some tenants feel that some landlords won't reasonably approve their buyer in an effort to drag out the tenant's sale and have the tenant eventually, the buyer eventually give up. The landlord gets the home. The landlord gets to sell it. Landlords sell homes in two situations: homes they own, they might have gotten it from the tenant, previous tenant, or they may sell homes on behalf of tenants on a consignment basis. In both of those situations, there have been some reports of friction. And so the bill tries to address both of those. And the resident that you're going to hear from a little bit later is going to talk about one of those particular situations. And that's a particular interest to Representative Nathanson. And we've done a number of things in the bill to try to address those two situations. The last thing I want to mention has to do with a bill that you all passed, the legislature passed in 2014. We called it the Opportunity to Purchase Bill. Landlords like to call it the right of first refusal bill, we thought our name sounded better. But we did work that out. That was actually an effort where eventually we had agreement between the two sides in the 2014 session, thanks to the leadership from Representative Nathanson and Representative Wisnant in the House, because we had brought in a bill that the coalition didn't support in 2013, and that committee said, go back and work this out and bring it back to us in 2014. We did. There were mistakes made in that bill. Shocking, isn't it? One of them is significant in that a cross-reference, a necessary cross-reference, wasn't done by legislative counsel in that bill, and I didn't catch it, so it's my fault for not catching it. But as a result, a significant tool for resident purchase of parks is not available as of January 1 of this year. There is a capital gains exemption for parks that are sold by landlords to their residents, or to a nonprofit, or to a housing authority. The concept being that that will maintain them as affordable housing. That capital gains exemption was created in 2005 under the leadership of Representative Crummell from Wilsonville in 2005, which was the height of the park closure crisis. So it was an effort to try to preserve parks and not have them be sold and redeveloped. It has been since the sunset on it has been renewed twice, most recently in 2013. The current sunset is 2020, so it's withstood review twice. It's an important tool. It's not used a whole lot, but it is important, both to landlords and to residents. And unfortunately, in the Opportunity to Purchase Bill, the language in that particular statute, it's a chapter law, didn't get corrected to refer to the new language that we used in the 2014 bill. So we're correcting that. We're not creating a new property tax, a new capital gains exemption. We're simply making the one that's been on the books since 2005 work.
Thank you.
That's probably more detail than the chair would have wanted.
Well, it's always,
once I get started, it's hard to stop.
It's always helpful to be explicit, and it's good to know there's someone that
pays attention, yes. Thank
and
you.
And loves
yes.
all of the ins and outs
yes,
with a passion.
Right.
Are there any questions?
Hey, everyone.
Senator Olson.
Thank you. How does a home end up with $43,000 in back taxes on it? Usually the county's on you after 3 years.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, I think part of that is the policy of the county is not to be collecting taxes on these homes in the communities now. But that's a really good question. I don't know how that happens to that extent. That's an enormous amount of money. That is sort of the outlier of what we deal with. Typically, it's several thousand dollars. It's enough to tip it to the point where a landlord or community owner is going to look at this and say, I'm not going to pay $2,500 in taxes on a home that's worth $1,500.
Yeah.
So the home is destroyed. But there are these incidences that come up. As I said, they're outliers, and they end up being significant amount of money.
So if I could add a little bit, Madam Chair, Senator Olson, one of the things that we learned is that some of the counties feel like they do have some tools to collect those back taxes for manufactured homes in parks. But one of those tools is actually seizing the home and pulling it out of the park and dragging it off somewhere, like an automobile.
Not a good tool.
And it's not a good tool. You know, they don't want to have a couple of old manufactured homes in their parking lot. But Linn County has recently, we've learned, seized homes, left them in the park, and then sold them in the park. Now, you have to have a cooperative landlord to make that work, because the landlord has the right to approve or reject the buyer. That's one of the frictions that we've got here in this relationship. I think Chuck's first answer, though, was the right one. That's pretty high. What we're typically seeing is in the range of $5,000 to $10,000 as the unpaid back taxes.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Further questions? Seeing none, thank you both very much. And last up, we have Donna McAdams and Susan from Linn County. Thank you. Welcome.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Susan Sparks, and I am a constituent of House District 13. Thank you for the opportunity to testify regarding House Bill 3016. I am a real estate agent, and I'm well acquainted with the high standards that are imposed upon an agent licensed with the state of Oregon in the matter of working with buyers and sellers and the ensuing conflicts of interest that can arise. I'll be 60 years old this August, currently live in a 55 and older manufactured home park in Eugene, Oregon. Based on my experience of over a decade of working in the real estate business, it is clear to me that the manager or owner of a manufactured park who is leasing or renting the land upon which residents own a home while actively buying and selling homes in that same park presents himself as a competitor for the buyers who might be interested in a home a resident has for sale. Further, he is solely empowered to approve or disapprove those buyers or renters. My personal experience is that upon finishing the approval process to lease a lot, the manager asked my husband how much he paid for the home. Upon hearing the price, the manager dramatically threw his head down into his hands, resting on the desk, then made the declaration that he paid too much, which I knew was not a true statement based on my market analysis. And in fact, the house was purchased at below market value. During a subsequent meeting, he told me that he could save me some money by selling me a brand new home, although it would put me in debt $30,000. The problem with these statements is that he is working with senior citizens who might actually believe his statements to be true simply because he has been the park manager for a number of years and should have firsthand knowledge of market information. Senior citizens routinely have mounting physical and sometimes mental limitations and can be preyed upon by those who believe to be experienced authorities and are often victims of scams. It would have profited the manager to sell that new home. As a real estate agent, I am not allowed to make future market predictions or make misleading and false statements because of the fact that I do have market information and experience and am seen as an authority. Because every buyer is required to meet with a manager for lot lease approval, it gives the manager private access to prospective buyers who might not have any representation and who have received no disclosure about who the manager is working for. It is not uncommon for the manager to steer the buyer to the homes he is handling the sale on and make declarative statements in favor of his interests. Many of our residents have told their heirs to just give the title of their home to the manager and walk away so that they are no longer saddled with lot rent and the inability to sell the home, because time after time sales do not close unless the manager is handling the sale. But even then, if there is opportunity, he may offer the resident a low price and, without disclosing any of his interest, sell the home for a far higher price, all the while with knowledge of a prospective buyer. As an Oregonian and a manufactured home resident, I support House Bill 3016. Homes are often the biggest asset an estate has, and the impact on elderly residents is huge with no accountability in place. Requiring a selling manager to be licensed will allow residents an oversight of conduct that is grossly lacking in the current state of affairs. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Donna McAdams, and I am a constituent of House District 13. Thank you for this opportunity to speak before you and tell you why I wholeheartedly support House Bill 3016. I live in a 55 and over park, and many of the residents are quite old and or in poor health or not mentally up to speed. For many of us, our homes are our biggest monetary asset. When the time comes for us to sell, we want to get a fair price for them because that might be the bulk of the money that we'll have to live on for the rest of our lives. When we send our buyers to the office to apply for a park approval, we should be able to trust that the manager won't undermine our sales, chase off our realtors, or try to divert our buyers into buying or renting one of the park's houses. I'd like to give you my personal example of the conflict of interest that we're faced with and why this bill is so important. I bought my house in November 2009. When I approached the manager about purchasing, we spoke about a home that was priced at $45,000. The manager told me that because the owners slash sellers of that house were behind in their rent, that he could get me that house, or get them to sell me that house for $35,000. I hired a real estate agent to represent me, and she wrote an offer for $30,000, which was accepted. When I applied for park approval, the manager told me that I paid too much for it. I believe that using financial knowledge of other tenants to influence the price of a manufactured home is unfair. My sister, a year later, my sister bought her home from park management for $10,000, then later learned that the very same day that she bought the house, he had bought it from the original owner for $1,500 and sold it to my sister for $10,000. The documentation is filed with public records, and it reflects that the original seller had sold it directly to my sister for $10,000 when in fact she only got $1,500 for it. I'd also like to talk about the house on space number 146. It had been vacant and for sale for several months. Karen called the manager to show it to her, but he told her that it was very small and had a weird floor plan. He made her look at all the other houses that he had for sale before he'd even let her see it. She did buy the house. I also know of others that he swayed away from buying that house and into buying one of his houses. In the meantime, the seller has to pay space rent on that vacant house. There are many examples of this type of context, and that is why we really need the protections in this bill. Thank you for allowing me this time to speak to you.
Thank you. Are there any questions for this panel? Thank you very much, and thanks for coming. It makes such a difference to have people come and talk about what it actually looks like when it's happening in someone's life. It makes it much more clear than just looking at the words on the paper, and I really appreciate your stepping up to share.
Thank you so much.
We appreciate the opportunity and to say how important it is to us. Thank you.
Thank you both very much. Is there anybody else that would like to be heard on House Bill 3016A? Seeing that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3016A. We are going to work the bill today, but not until Senator Dimbrough gets here. So we will be good when that gets back, and Senator Cruz, when we get to that point, is going to carry the bill. So it's because he's my favorite. Sorry, Senator Olson. I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2195.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2195A requires counties to use proceeds acquired by foreclosure of delinquent tax liens for housing placement and support of youth and families with children, for rental assistance, and for low-income housing. It requires these priorities in counties with populations less than 650,000, permits these priorities in counties with populations more than 650,000. It modifies language prioritizing reimbursement of costs to quiet title to include boundary determinations. It permits remaining proceeds from foreclosure of delinquent tax liens to be credited to a county's general fund after payment of costs and affordable housing priorities. It makes explicit that counties of 650,000 or more may convey foreclosed properties to any government body if it's not needed for public use, and properties donated to government units or nonprofits for specified purposes. There is an A4 amendment that was received, and is available on OLIS, that makes a correction applying the provisions of 2195A only to Multnomah County with population of 650,000 or more, and not those with less. Came off of the House, out of the House committee unanimously, and off the House floor 4812. There is no revenue impact on the A4. I'm sorry, the A4 is still pending. The A5 is still pending. They're not ready. There's no revenue impact on the underlying measure, no fiscal on the underlying measure.
Great. Thank you. Chris Fick, Mary Carroll, and Randy Woolrift, please. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Chair Gelser, other members of the committee. For the record, I'm Chris Fick with Multnomah County's Office of Government Relations. Before I hand it off to Ms. Carroll and Mr. Woolrift, I want to do just a couple things in my testimony. I want to give you a quick overview of how the tax foreclosure process currently works at the county level, some information on amendments that we're seeking and that aren't yet ready, and explain why this is a Multnomah County-only bill that we're requesting. First, just for some background, and it was touched upon in the earlier testimony, when a property does not pay its property taxes, it's about a five-year process, but when the county does take control of that property, it has a couple different options. It can either donate the property for four specific purposes. That's for open space, social services, child care services, or affordable housing, or it can sell the property. And if it chooses the latter, to sell the property, it then distributes the proceeds after deducting our expenses to all the taxing districts throughout the county. So in Multnomah County, over the past 10 years, we've taken possession of about 18 properties annually on average and sold them for about $650,000 on average. So we're not talking about a huge number of properties. We also donate about three properties on average for affordable housing because it is such a huge issue in the metropolitan area. So that's the pool of money. And by the time the $650,000 is sprinkled out amongst the 58 taxing districts, it doesn't amount to a whole lot of money for any one entity. But because we have an issue regarding homelessness, and in particular homeless youth and families with children, we had the idea to perhaps pool this money if we could get the endorsement of other taxing districts and dedicate it for that purpose and dedicate a funding stream for that purpose in particular. After all, when it comes to homeless children and their families, it's something that affects public safety agencies, schools, our social services, so we thought it was a good tool to explore. We have informed our other taxing districts both via email and with standard mail of our intentions and received no opposition. As Ms. Carroll is going to state, the City of Portland, Gresham, and Portland Public Schools are also outright supportive as well. The amendments that you've heard are not quite ready yet because we do want this to be a Multnomah County-only bill. We're not trying to eliminate the options that other counties have to donate the property to those other four purposes and distribute the proceeds. We did take this idea to the Association of Oregon Counties and explore with our county partners whether they were interested in this authority, and other counties simply were not at this time. They didn't view the crisis as being acute enough to warrant this new authority, so it's simply an expanded authority that we're seeking for Multnomah County, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you have, and I'll turn it over to Ms. Carroll.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair Gelser, members of the committee. Thank you for allowing me to testify on behalf of House Bill 2195, which, as Chris has said, will allow Multnomah County to dedicate funds from the sale of tax foreclosed properties to house and to respond to the needs of homeless youth and families with children. For the record, my name is Mary Carroll, and I'm here today on behalf of Multnomah County in my role as Senior Policy Advisor to Chair Deborah Cofori. During the 2013-2014 academic year, 2,985 students in Multnomah County reported being homeless at some point during the school year. This is about 4.1%, which is much higher than the statewide average of 3.35%. The problems present multiple challenges for the school district, for social service providers, public safety, and others, and requires new resources to adequately address. Last year, our community adopted a shared governance model called Home for Everyone to coordinate public and private investments and policies to respond to the crisis of homelessness in Multnomah County. The crisis is well documented. Every night, over 1,800 people are unsheltered in Multnomah County. The cities of Portland, Gresham, Home Forward, Meyer Memorial Trust, and Multnomah County are working together on a coordinated, well-defined approach of focusing our resources on priority populations to achieve our community goals. In January, the committee adopted an ambitious community plan which sets two measurable goals. We're going to end all veterans' homelessness by the end of this year, and we're going to reduce the unmet need of those experiencing homelessness by 50% within 2 years. We've prioritized vulnerable populations, which include homeless youth, families with children, and veterans. Mayor Hales and Chair Kefauri have just released their budgets, which dedicate significant new resources to our shared goal of housing 600 homeless veterans by the end of this year and increasing our housing placement from 3,000 to 4,000 people per year over the next 2 years. We support House Bill 2195 so that our county can use these funds to invest in our community's plan and to increase flexible rent assistance and retention activities to move youth and families into housing and provide the supports they need to stay housed. We're also going to create more affordable units for very low-income priority populations. Our biggest challenge in moving people from housing are rising rents and a minuscule 1% vacancy rate for affordable units in our county. We believe that investing these funds in a strategic and coordinated plan to address the crisis of homelessness is the highest and best use of these public funds. We're pleased these bills have the support of our largest taxing districts, the cities of Portland and Gresham, and Portland Public Schools. These investments will be closely monitored and evaluated to assess our progress and report, and we will report outcomes to the community. Thank you for allowing me to provide this testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair Gelser, members of the committee. I'm Randy Walruff. I'm the Multnomah County Assessor and Tax Collector, and I'm here today for technical questions you may have around the process, but I will just give you a little brief rundown of what happens is we levy the property taxes each year by May 15th. If you haven't paid your taxes, then you become delinquent for that tax year. After 3 years, then you start to go into the foreclosure process. It takes about 6 months to get a judgment. Then you have a right of redemption period where you have another 2 years to live in the property, hopefully figure out a way to catch up, make the situation better for yourself. But then there's a few situations where it just doesn't happen. And so close to 6 years after that tax bill went out, as the tax collector, I need to foreclose on the property. And then the process starts of the property now is in ownership of the county. Many times the properties are vacated, people move on, different situations. There's distressed properties involved. But sometimes they're occupied. And when they're occupied, then we're in a bad spot. I work with Mayor Carroll in the chair's office. How can we help these people? We've made a very significant commitment at Multnomah County. The chair doesn't want anyone put out on the street. She's tried to dedicate resources, but resources are limited to how to help these people. Luckily, one story I have was a couple years ago. We had a family out in Rockwood, and the father was disabled. The mother had been deceased. Three teenage daughters in the home. Taxes had not been paid. They ended up in a county commissioner's office. What can we do? Limited resources. Luckily, in this one case, we just donated to a nonprofit a condominium we were unable to sell. We contacted that
nonprofit, and they agreed to work with these people and move them, these young girls, high school girls, and their father into the condominium. They went into the home, and that home actually still stayed the county, and we were able to sell that, and then the proceeds after our expenses did go into the distribution schedule. What this program would do, and that was took a lot of scrambling to find a nonprofit. This program and this bill would allow Multnomah County and Carol and her resources to have resources in order to help find a place for these young people. This is just one example of many that we see every year, and I'm available to answer questions for you.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions for this panel? No, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And are you waiting for other amendments besides the amendment that we worked on?
Chair Gelser, yes. The amendment that you worked on, we got it late. It's not quite ready, so we will have another round of amendments, and we apologize for that. But it will do, as we've intended, make this Multnomah County-specific bill for counties larger than 650,000 and not affect the process currently in place in other counties.
Great. Thank you very much. Thank you all very much. Is there anybody else that wants to be heard on House Bill 2195? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2195 and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2889A.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2889A directs the Department of Human Services to permit and monitor savings accounts for children age 12 or older in their custody via rulemaking. It entitles children in DHS custody for 6 months or more to assistance establishing savings accounts, prohibits DHS or other legal guardians from establishing accounts on behalf of the child, allows DHS to monitor use of the child's money relating to state and federal benefits. Dash 5 amendments were just received. They're yet to be summarized, but they are available at the dais. This came out of House Committee 8-1 and off the House floor 58-1, no revenue impact and no fiscal impact on the and gross version of the bill.
Great, thank you. James Berta, Nathan Schwab, and Kane Stellings. Unless, James, you want to come first and then have the three come after you?
I can do that.
Okay, let's do that. So please hold.
Well, Chair Gelsel, members of the committee, my name is James Berta. My role is simply to introduce the three next names on that list, but it's been a real pleasure to work with the foster youth in addition to other stakeholders, and it's their bill. They've been working on it, and so I'm going to let them talk about it.
Great. Thank you very much. So now Nathan Schwab, Kane Stellings, and Joshua Ashbaugh, please. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, my name is Nathaniel Schwab, and I have been with OFYC for plus 2 years now. And OFYC, Oregon Foster Youth Connection, is a youth-led program devoted to foster youth advocacy. And we have had recent success with a lot of bills, and we thank all of you for helping us with passing those. And today we will be presenting bill ideas from youth who attended the last summer policy conference. And in this session, we will be bringing bills on the topic of saving accounts and extracurricular activities. And I will pass this over to Kane.
And can I ask you all a question really quick?
Yeah.
Your testimony, is it structured to do both of the bills at the same time? Okay, good. Because I could open the other one if you want, but...
Yeah, I think we're just starting.
Okay, very good. Thanks.
Good afternoon, Chair Senator Gelser.
Gelser, rhymes with Alka-Seltzer.
Yeah, thanks. and members of the committee, my name's Kane Stellings. I've spent about 5 years in Oregon's foster care, been involved with OFYC for about 2.5, 3 years, freshman at Lane Community College. And we're here today to share with you HB 2889, savings account. As we were getting ready to bring this bill to Capitol, we found some Oregon laws that might help out in the process. First off, it's every child and young adult in legal custody has the right to earn and keep their own money, but they also have the right to guidance to figure out how they're going to invest that in their future. Also, we found out that when a child is 14 years of age or older, they are to be provided with information regarding how to open a bank account. So we figured that would be an extra plus. And we found that the state independent living program runs credit reports annually starting at 16. But as of September 2015, they will start running reports at 14 per federal regulation. How these come together so well with ours, it's with our legislation. Youth will start practicing financial responsibility before the age of 18. We encourage youth to open a savings account at the age of 12, so that way they are easier, like they can practice money better. And at this age, they're usually easier to influence when it comes to saving, because like I know if somebody told me at 12, if you save up $600, I'd throw down $600 to help you get another car. Like, to get a car, because that's what my parents did, the Dave Ramsey approach. and so that's just one thing. Not all foster parents do that. Youth will be able to have the opportunity to learn through their actions much earlier, and this is just one of those other things, that they'll be able to handle their money and practice a little bit more before they actually get thrown out into the real world of living. All right, so now I will pass it on to my teammate, Joshua.
Chair Gelser and members of the committee. My name is Joshua Ashbaugh, and I've been in foster care for about 6.5 years, and this is my first year being involved in OFYC. I'm going to share with you guys just a short story on financial literacy in my life. So when I was young, I grew up with money kind of being important, but not important to me, and so I didn't have the education at a young age to the purpose of how to save money. And every time I got money, I wanted to spend it. It was very rarely that I got money, so when I got it, I wanted to use it on candy and energy drinks and coffee and stuff at a young age. And so that lifestyle continued until about ninth grade. I moved into a permanent foster care home where I was with my best friend, and he asked me one day if I had a savings account, and I told him that I didn't. And his parents started right there, and that was one of the first things that they did, is they took me down to the bank and I established a savings account and learned financial literacy. And it not only helped with that, but also time management, as well as how to save effectively. And so that was a big role that helped me a lot, and that's why I'm excited about this bill, is because the main focus is financial literacy, and it will be solely on the youth to be responsible for their savings. And we've been working with banks and credit unions to develop the details on how to amend this bill so that it benefits both the financial institution as well as the youth. For one example is to resolve how youth will maintain access to their money if they were to move. So if they were to move from Bend to Portland, credit unions have a network that oversees other credit unions and allows easy access to one's funding or savings. And we plan to use that, as well as 7-Eleven allows services to use your money at any 7-Eleven for your convenience. And we've also been working with DHS. We've given them the ability to monitor accounts for youth on SSI so that they don't lose benefits that exceed, if they were to exceed over to the maximum limit. We've also been working with DHS to create a document that not only informs the youth on how to establish an account, but also how to save effectively, as well as act as an ID for the financial institutions to ensure that the youth is eligible for an account. And feel free to answer any questions as well.
So we'll finish. We'll do all three, and then we'll do the questions at the end.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. So I believe, yeah, that is the end of that one. We would also like to thank the stakeholders as well, DHS, the credit unions, and also the Foster Parent Association for working with us.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for this panel? Senator Olson.
I've been doing a little research and talking to some of the banks. Have you talked to the banks about being able to open an account with a bank, such as U.S. Bank or West Coast Bank or Far West? Or
we've been talking to the lobbyists, and to answer your, I'm not exactly sure on the answer to that question. We have talked to them, but not necessarily in depth.
So. And the reason, follow up. The reason I asked the question is the banks that I have talked to are concerned about the contractual obligation because there's no liability with a 12-year-old or 14-year-old. And if the account was to be overdrawn, they would have no recourse. And that's a concern to them. And so I asked, what is your policy? And the policy for their banks is that they have someone sign. And I know this is very specific that there will be no co-signers to the account. I understand you have done this with credit unions. Do you have plans to work with the banks that are available to see if you can establish these accounts?
Chair Gelser, Senator Olson, we do plan to add these into the bill. Yes, we actually have that in my notes. We are adding that finance. They're not obligated to determine if the child is allowed to open it, just because we do want to make sure they do not have overdraft, because that would create a line of credit. And so we are trying to avoid that, and we are working on pieces of the bill as well as with the banks to establish those details on that bill.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there?
Well, just to follow up, I haven't reviewed. Have we gotten any testimony from the Banking Association?
So we've not received any testimony from the Banking Association. However, I am confident that they know that we have this, are having this hearing, because I saw Tim Martinez sitting in the back of the room just a minute ago, and he left. And so I would expect that if he had concerns, he probably would have put his name on the list.
Madam Chair, if I could, I just had a conversation with him. They're a little concerned with some of the language on page 1, line 21. They think entitled to is a shall, which it's not supposed to be. So I think they would like the opportunity to sit down with these gentlemen and make they aren't opposed. They just want to make sure that the language is right. And bankers tend to be kind of picky about words, so. So I would hope that I'm sure they're more than happy to sit down and make sure that the language says what it's intended to say. So,
and we do have testimony in the record from the credit unions, who of course have been very helpful and supportive. Are there any other questions for this group? Thank you very much. So it sounds like, if I understand correctly, you're still working on some more amendments. I see a little bit of sign language in the back.
It's just clarification stuff at this point.
Right.
I think, so.
Right. I'm just more thinking for timing. Do you know what the language? James, could you come back? Could you come back up? And if all of you know, do you know if you have the language that you need to submit? And do you have a note, or do you need a note?
Chair Gelser, we'll need a note, but it is a matter of just a may and a shall.
Okay.
That's it.
Yeah.
And that's my understanding in my conversations, yes.
Great.
So as long as we can do that quickly so we can move this along.
Very good. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Madam Chair, that means that the A5 that were just received don't do what you need them to do. It would be another.
Okay. And will you have that one encompass the -5 that removes Section 7?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. And I had asked for the Section 7 to be removed. It described the treatment of children with intellectual and developmental disabilities differently than all other children. And any kid in foster care should be treated the same way.
Madam Chair, in the notes on the SMS, it says that young children could be financially vulnerable. So my concern to that was, in my notes there, I have, well, who provides protection for that vulnerability if DHS and foster parents can't oversee this account?
Chair Gessler, Senator Olson, we do have some steps in place to address that. Again, the main purpose of this bill is to create financial literacy And the most that a youth could potentially be in danger of credit or owing money or any such is underway with the changing the line of credit with overdraft protection and making sure those steps are in place. So, yeah, we plan to make the minimum, if none, with the savings account. That's why we wanted to open a savings account for a youth, is so there were no steps to create vulnerability.
No, well, just to clarify, the Madam Chair, the SMS says that they are currently potentially financially vulnerable, and that's why they need the financial literacy skills to help make them less vulnerable.
And I can appreciate that, but there still needs to be a umbrella of protection that says you're going down the wrong path.
Chair Kelser, Senator Olson, yeah, this is something that we've definitely discussed on the House side. First, you know, two things. One, well, three things, really. One is it's a savings account, which is very difficult to overdraft. I'm not saying it's impossible. It is just very difficult. Two, starting this fall, DHS will be doing regular yearly credit checks for the youth starting at age 14. And that's an opportunity to make sure that nothing is amiss. And finally, three, I think going back to the financial literacy argument, it's if not now, while they have these oversights of foster parents and DHS doing credit checks, when? Because eventually they'll be adults and they won't have the literacy skills to make those same mistakes. You know, they might be making those same mistakes when there isn't the oversight and when there isn't the stakes are higher. And so, yes, there is a chance that there'll be a problem, but I would fully expect that they would be small and it would be a learning experience and we will be able to move on and have productive adults in society.
And I would imagine that for many foster youth that vulnerability in young adulthood without the opportunity to practice money management skills is more significant because you can't overdraw your account or miss your rent and have your mom or your dad or your aunt or uncle to kind of help you out of that, help you out of that bind. So the ability to practice and not make mistakes in adulthood seems even more important for this. Am I making wrong assumptions?
I believe so.
Senator Gelsler, chairs of the committee, I would like to point out that before moving to college, I was not financially dependent. I mean, I wasn't taught anything about handling money. So I made lots of mistakes already this first year, at my first year at college. I don't know, it's just one of those things that youth really will have to learn through on hands, and like they can learn it through others. It's just one of those things that I think as we establish at a younger age, youth will be able to look at it as like, I have a bank account and I have it for a reason. And that's for me to save up money for things like a car or college or something like that. A few candy bars, maybe at the store, you know? So I think that that's the main reason why we're wanting to do that. Yeah.
Don't get me wrong. I support this bill.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to make sure that to learn these mistakes that you mentioned, you need to have a mentor there with you to say that you just did wrong. I mean, you will find out financially that you've done wrong. But when you get younger than yourself, like 12 years old, that's a little difficult. And if they put $25 or $50 into a savings account, and first off, if a bank, you know, the question I had about will a bank take that, will they open the savings account? I hope they do. It'd be great if they did. That way the little girl can or a little boy can go in and make their deposits, and that would be a cool thing to see them do. But the fact is that if mistakes are going to be made, because we talk about their financial vulnerability, you never know when someone is going to have an influence to say, I know they've got $100 in there, maybe I can get them to give me $50. And my concern is that we have a mentor to make certain, because the foster parents can't watch them, DHS can't watch them. So who actually is that mentor that says that this is the right move or the wrong move?
Chair Gelser, Senator Olson, I think in that situation you illustrate, which you know we've all been burned in our lives, it's better to be burned at the $50 level than later in life when there isn't a system there. So it's unfortunate. It could happen, but the best way to learn is to do, and it's keep the stakes low while we're doing that learning.
I'd say that level of financial vulnerability, it's less if the money's in a bank than if it's in your pocket, mm-hmm. number one. But I'm trying to figure out, you know, the liability issue if there is a bank account and they draw it down to zero and they have a service charge on the account would be about all I would think that the vulnerability would be from that aspect of it.
I do have another question.
Senator Olson?
Because Senator Cruz just reminded me of it. Some banks require a minimum deposit.
True.
And so the question is how would...
Minimum deposit. Deposit.
To open an account, you need $100.
Okay.
Right.
So the question is, how would you circumvent that? Or would you? Maybe you could work it out with the banks.
Great. Also, Senator Olson, yes, this even when if this bill becomes law, we have plenty of work ahead of us because that's the type of details that we're already talking about with the credit unions and beginning that conversation with the banks as well.
Okay, yeah. Cool.
Thank you.
So a little bit more work to do.
Oh, yes.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much. Is there anybody else that wants to be heard on House Bill 2889?
With the mustache.
You are not required to, but credit unions and banks, do you wish to participate in the conversation at this point, or have we covered it? All right. Great. Thank you very much. And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2889. Why don't you all just stay right there? I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2890.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2890A directs the Department of Human Services to provide for participation in extracurricular activities for children in its care and coordination with agencies and foster parents, defines extracurricular activities, defines a reasonable and prudent parenting standards, and Dash A2 amendment has been received, and Dash A3, the Dash A3 hasn't yet been summarized. The Dash A2 specifies that the child gets to choose the activity and clarifies that a summer camp or a church activities alone do not satisfy the requirement. And the A3s are not yet prepared, but the Dash A2 has no revenue impact and no fiscal impact. Again, this is unanimous off the floor and out of House committee.
Thank you very much.
I'm assuming we want the A3s, so, correct?
Correct.
The most recent ones, yes. Yeah.
So, Chair Gelser, members of the committee, for the record, my name is James Barta, and you've already gotten to know these individuals, these young men next to me, but... again, it's their bill, and been enjoying working with them. So I will let them take it away.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, my name, again, is Nathaniel Schwab. And last summer, there was a policy conference, and the youth also wanted to allow more access to extracurricular activities on top of opening individual savings accounts, which we discussed earlier. And we found that the federal government also agreed on HB 4980, and that was the Preventing Sex Trafficking and Strengthening Families Act. And we have addressed some of those concerns. And you may have seen HB 298 presented by DHS this session to address the changes needed after the passage of this federal legislation. And that defines prudent parenting standards, and foster parents will now be able to make the decision to allow the youth to participate in not only extracurricular activities, but also cultural enrichment and social activities. And we believe that this is a wonderful step to allow increased access. And our bill is different because it highlights that all children and youth have the opportunity, if they are interested, to participate in at least one age or developmentally appropriate extracurricular activity, and that could be either a playdate with a neighbor, basketball or community youth group, or something that is important to the youth, that which they wish to pursue. And there will also be more accountability for DHS, foster parents, youth, and communities to problem solve together through challenges of children and youth not being able to participate in something that interests them. And not all youth are strong self-advocates and may need a team of adults to help address these situations. And barriers that this will address is that we hope that the youth and foster parents will feel both supported by DHS and the community to work through the needs of youth in their home. And since introducing this bill, we have heard about a variety of resources for youth and families, from school waivers, including fees, and an association called Friends of Baseball, which allow for help with equipment or scholarships, and the Foster Parent Association, just to name a few. And with the help of DHS, we hope that other input we have amended our bill with to state that we have added a few definitions as they are used in the federal legislation, and we have also clarified some language as requested by DHS. And a little bit on my personal story regarding this bill is I used to be in foster care, and I was in care for about 2 years with my 8-year-old sister at the time. And for me, I was going through sophomore year of high school, and it was a really difficult part of my life. And with the help of extracurricular activities and sport, I was able to get through that. And an example was that I participated in Wolf Choir and cross country, and the opportunities to participate in those not only grew me as a Wolf leader and opened me to responsibility and accountability skills, it also provided me with a family when I couldn't be with my own. And to me, that is both a really strong personal preference, and I believe that every youth should have the option to and the opportunity to ensure that they maintain a positive experience through care in hopes that they will get back with their family. And yeah, so now I will hand this over to Kane, and we'll be happy to answer any of your questions after his spiel. So.
Chair Gelser and members of the committee, I am a wrestler. I wrestled all 4 years.
Can you say your name for the record? Even though we know you really well
so
now.
Sorry. Okay, for the record, my name is Kane Stellings, and I am the wrestler of 4 years from a small school called Embler. Wrestling was one of those things throughout high school that just made me proud. I'm still proud to be a wrestler. I wrestled all throughout my high school career. It was very important for me as I was making the transition from my life before foster care to my life in foster care. It really helped because, like, I knew every day at 4 I was going to go up to the wrestling mats and I'm going to roll around with all of my best friends for 2.5 hours. That's just what I did for 4 years. Wrestling built me a sense of pride. I've worked, I've sweated, and I've bled with some of these men. And personally, these men have earned my trust. Like, they've shown me that they're willing to go above and beyond to help me be a better individual and a better athlete. So that just means to me that I'm willing to trust them to make sure that I don't get cracked when I'm playing football, because I was a football player too, just to make sure that I don't get blindsided. They were my teammates. I trusted them. Last but not least, my wrestling team was the size of 14. It wasn't a very big wrestling team. But out of those 14 wrestlers, we had 4 4.0 students. And our wrestling coach, being the superintendent of this school, he didn't allow us to go on any bus rides longer than 4 hours without taking homework with us because there were 4.0 students on the bus ready to help us, and it was because of this experience I was able to pass science and math my senior year. And through this, I made lasting friendships, friendships that last forever. There was a wrestler on my team. I really looked up to him my freshman year, and he was only a junior. And he graduated, and just the last week, ran into him in Eugene. Next week, we're going out for a burger. And the first thing that we talked about when we ran into each other is, hey, do you remember what so-and-so did on the bus? Or do you remember what happened on the mats or during this wrestling trip? It's really those special memories that get made. And really, it's that type of family that just will always be there for you. And they see you every day, and they know what you're going through. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Chair Gelser and members of the committee, my name is Joshua Ashbaugh, for the record. I'd like to share a short story as well with extracurricular activities. Growing up, I was involved in basketball. Was kind of like the main thing through the struggle. Staying active and staying fit was really important to me. And then around ninth grade, I moved into my permanent foster home, and my neighbor actually invited me to church. And before that moment, I thought church was just somewhere I would go to gain hope if I was down, or sing if I wanted to sing, or things of such. I didn't really take church as such a prideful activity until this moment. My neighbor took me, and I felt so welcomed at this church that I started to open up to certain individuals, and we started to share struggles and experiences, and actually found out that some of them were in foster care and some of them have experienced true struggle. And I feel like to go through struggle, to understand it, you really have to go through it. And so I lived by that for a long time, and I started to really humble myself, and extracurricular activities really helped me. And I started to think, as this bill came up when I got involved with OFYC, is that, well, some foster youth aren't as fortunate as, say, us three. And I've realized that too in independent living program meetings. I've met some individuals where they have problems with speaking, or they don't make friends as well, or their problems are so heavy on them that they can't live sort of a normal life. And so I feel really, really bad about that. And so passing this bill will create such an importance, and it'll open up their eyes to where they can have something obligated to them, to where they can start to get out of their comfort zone and go do something that they would want to do. And it's really important to me as well, this bill. So thank you.
Thank you all very much. This is a great bill. Yep. Just a really, really good bill. Are there any questions for this group? Senator Dimbrough.
Thanks, Madam Chair. It's as much a statement as anything. You know, it's just a treat for me to hear you bring these bills forward, because last summer I was at the retreat out at Pacific University where the OFYC participants decided on these as the priorities, and to see it, you know, having come through the House and now coming to the Senate, it's just great to see this, you know, coming to fruit. And I will say that I remember hearing there, you know, from several students, we went over these we broke out into tables, and hearing some stories about kids who were not able to do extracurricular activities the way they had wanted to. It just, you know, their foster parents weren't interested, or, you know, not inclined to make the time to support them in that. And so, you know, I think, you know, making it clear that this is an expectation of fosterhood, I think it's really important.
Madam Chair. Senator
Olson.
Great bill. Heard it a long time ago. I still remember the story of the young gentleman that couldn't play soccer anymore. It bothered me. Talked to DHS and said, when you interview prospective foster parents, do you tell them that, you know, you got to take the kids to sports because that's part of life? And she says, well, maybe we ought to look at that. This is cool. The amendment really fits the bill, the dash 3, really fits the bill. Good luck. This is a great bill.
Thank you.
Further. Are you leaning forward to say something?
No, Madam Chair, I'd just say, because we met in my office, and you guys are awesome. You've done a great job. You really have.
Thank you. Thank you so much. You guys have been very effective. You've worked hard. You've asked good questions, made good changes. So this, we don't have the fiscal back on this bill, but we'll schedule it for a work session on the same day we do the savings account bill so we can keep the two bills moving together. But we will schedule them. We'll make sure to get you a note so we can get that shall to may all switched up. And with that, is there anybody else that would like to be heard on this bill?
Yeah, me. One more. I got one more
thing. Okay, Senator Olson.
back to the savings account. I ask those questions because I try to smooth out the bumps so that you don't run into a roadblock down the road so that you might be thinking about it. That's why I ask that stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and it's very much appreciated.
I don't want to stop it. That's a good bill, too. I just want to let you know that there could be something down the road you could run into. And maybe you could fix it before you get there.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Thank you all very much. And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2890. And I'm going to open up a work session on House Bill 3016A. Colleagues, this is the bill we heard at the beginning of the meeting from the Landlord Tenant Coalition. And it does not need an amendment. It's right here.
No. I need it.
And it's 3016.
Be at the top, second page. Are
we in work session? We're
in work session. Chair Gelser, I move House Bill 3016A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Olson moves House Bill 3016A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition?
Yes, because he's going to carry it, and I want it.
Okay, except for that. So I have to ask the question again.
Yes.
No. Is there opposition. Any opposition to the bill going to the floor?
None.
Seeing none, so ordered. And Senator Cruz, despite Senator Olson's objection, you will carry the bill. Will there be a minority report on the carrier?
No, absolutely. On the carrier. Could be.
On the carrier, yeah. I can understand that.
Michael, you and I, let's do that one.
I'd be happy to join.
You know, I would love to see the response of the Senate President's office if we sent such a message saying we wanted to do this on the carrier.
On the carrier. That would
be awesome.
All right. I'm going to close the... That door is going to come swinging open in a second here. I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 3016 and open up a work session on House Bill 2232A.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2232A requires the Department of Human Services to appoint an advisory committee on coordination of statewide services for homeless and unaccompanied youth, specifies the committee role and composition, requires DHS to submit an annual report to the legislature by September 15th, and declares emergency effective on passage. This comes to us with no revenue, minimal fiscal impact, no subsequent referral, unanimous out of the House committee, and unanimous off the House floor.
Great. Senator Olson.
Work session? We're there.
We are in a work session.
Chair Gelser, I move House Bill 2232A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Olson moves House Bill 2232A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Who would like to carry this one?
It's my bill.
Oh, how about we let Senator Mom Sanderson carry the bill? All
right. Another minority report, I see.
So Senator Mona Sanderson will carry the bill. Thank you. I'll close the work session on House Bill 2232A and open up a work session on House Bill 2694.
Chair Gelser, I move to adopt the -1 amendment dated 5-4-2015.
Vice Chair Olson moves to adopt the -1 amendment stated 5-4-2015. Colleagues, this is the bill that lets the social worker make the report. This is the amendment that we heard from the Dairy Association. It would make them feel happier. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection to the amendment? Seeing none, so ordered.
Chair Gelser, I move House Bill 2694 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Olson moves House Bill 2694 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection to the bill going to the floor? Seeing none, so ordered. And
I underlined that.
Why did you underline it? Oh, Olson carries. So would you like to carry the bill?
Yes, there you
all
go.
Right.
Shouldn't we have Senator Beyer carry it?
Oh, is it?
Is it Senator Beyer's bill?
His?
Roger Beyer.
Why is Senator Beyer? Yes, it would be great to have you carry this bill. Senator Olson is going to carry this bill. I'm closing the work session on House Bill 2694.
The role of this committee is really marginal at this moment, I think. So.
It is. So because of that, I'm going to send you all home. We're adjourned.
Thanks.